Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, Cynical listeners. I have a little clarification about an earlier show that I've tacked on to the end of this show, so listen to the end for that if you're interested, and enjoy.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China. From the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. What do we know about how Chinese people feel toward their political leaders? What can we say about popular attitudes toward individual political figures like Xi Jinping or Wang Qishan, toward the party itself, toward local and provincial officials versus the central government, toward specific policies, or toward China's foreign relations? Obviously, without the benefit of public opinion polling, except some, highly circumscribed and in most cases officially sanctioned polls, coming to any kind of rock-solid conclusions about any of this is really difficult. Our own sense of things, that's, based on our on-the-ground or sometimes online observations, is pretty unreliable, too. We suffer pretty badly from selection bias. We're unsure as we're reading through Weibo posts or the comment sections of news pieces of just who might be one of those paid commenters, one of those infamous members of the so-called 50 Cent Party or Wu Maodang. You read about that. These days, you can't always tell who's a bot either. And on the flip side, we're not sure whether the critical voices that we're reading might be maybe overrepresented on the platforms we're on, like Twitter, which requires a VPN for any Chinese people. And they tend to, attract dissidents and more strident critics. So even for those of us who are pretty confident that, broadly speaking, there's substantial support for the CCP within China, that Xi Jinping's approval ratings, if you will, are actually pretty high, or would be if you could measure them, even we're vexed by how imprecise we have to be. Getting any kind of a good sense of the size of support and how it differs geographically or demographically, how it varies by income or educational level or gender or any kind of more granular look at favorability on specific sets of issues, it's all basically impossible for us, or at least right now it is. So these issues, which have long been argued over by ordinary folks and veteran China watchers alike, are all coming to the fore for various reasons. Do ordinary Chinese secretly support the Hong Kong protesters, as some have suggested, or is harboring that kind of hope just plain delusional? How much of the ardent patriotism or nationalism or jingoism or whatever you want to call it, how much of that opposition to the Hong Kong protests that we see in Chinese communities of the diaspora from Sydney to Vancouver, how much of that is just a result of patriotic education or of propaganda or of deliberate mobilization or of censorship? How genuine was the feeling that we saw during the military parade on October 1st? How angry were ordinary Chinese people by the general manager of the Houston Rockets posting some tweet supporting the Hong Kong protests? All of this touches on really important issues about legitimacy and about on how to assess legitimacy in an authoritarian state. So joining me from Chicago today to discuss these issues is Neil Thomas, a researcher at Macro Polo, which is the in-house think tank of the Paulson Institute. Neil's been a guest twice, I think, on our sister show China Econ Talk, and always has very smart things to say. He's written a number of pieces that touch on today's topic, including a very recent one that ran on MarketWatch about the topic of popular support for the Chinese government and why American policymakers get it wrong. Neil, welcome to Seneca.
Thanks for having me, Kaiser. It's great to be here.
Thanks for taking the time to join. Let's talk first about this brief op-ed that you wrote in MarketWatch and that was published on October 2nd, very timely, right after the parade. If I had to summarize, basically, you do accept the claims of relatively high level of support for the party, and you've argued that the reason for this is basically, you know, what Bill Clinton's campaign said way back then. It's the economy, stupid. But it's not just the big abstract macro numbers, you know, the average annual GDP growth or life expectancy or infant mortality, all of that, but other numbers that kind of touch more lives more directly. Is that a fair characterization of your piece? And what would you say the really salient numbers are that bolster regime support?
Yeah, so I'd say I accept the claim that the evidence we do have suggests that there is high regime support in China, because as you mentioned in your intro, there are serious obstacles to doing the type of opinion polling that we're able to do in the West, in the United States, in Australia, or where have you, because of censorship, because of, you know, government opposition to doing this type of research. But there is a consistent finding of high regime support across multiple surveys by multiple international organizations that ask, you know, multiple versions of this same question. Whether that be support for the central government, for the Communist Party, for the China's political system. And we see high levels of confidence, trust, and perceptions of responsiveness in these surveys. So one in particular is the Pew Global surveys.
Mm-hmm.
And they've asked Chinese respondents the level of confidence they have in the Chinese leadership on three occasions before. They're not as recent as we'd probably like, but for instance, confidence in Hu Jintao was 86% in 2011, dipped a bit to 82% in 2012. And the one time they've asked that for Xi Jinping, which is in 2014, it was 92%, which compared to about, you know, 58 to 61% approval ratings for the US president in those years. So those are very high numbers. And we have similar findings in the World Values Survey, which was last conducted in China in 2013, which showed 38% of Chinese had a great deal of confidence in the government. 47% had quite a lot of confidence in the government, and only, you know, single figures had not very much or no confidence at all in the government.
Right.
So these are enormously high figures for any government, let alone a government that we, particularly in the West, don't see as deserving that type of support or legitimacy from its population because of its, you know, various policies that repress free speech and human rights. So it's quite a counterintuitive finding. And in terms of things like trust in political institutions, there is some more recent data that comes from Edelman, which is a public relations firm. They have a trust barometer that they release each year. And the most recent one to look at global trust was in 2018. And they recorded that 84% of Chinese respondents trusted their government, which was actually up from 76% in their same survey the year before in 2017. And actually, a significant majority also believed that government in China was the institution most likely to lead to a better future. And that was as compared to business and media and NGOs. And we have similar findings of high majorities believing in the responsiveness of the Chinese government in some Asian barometer surveys. These are from about 10 years ago, but, you know, 78% of Chinese then, you know, agreed the government would, you know, generally respond to what people needed. So these are consistent findings across multiple surveys done by, you know, international organizations who are, you know, at the cutting edge of public opinion research. And the findings are fairly surprising, and that is, yeah, there is a high level of regime support within China.
Surprising, certainly, from the perspective of a lot of the Westerners, anyway. What about the critique of this? You'll often hear this all the time. Well, of course, you know, they'd be lined up and shot were they to answer otherwise. I mean, of course, that's a ridiculous exaggeration, but
you know, it makes the point that there is coercion, that there is maybe a price to pay for expressing dissenting opinions. Do you take any of these results with a grain of salt, or do you discount them? Do you sort of mentally knock off a few points accounting for this?
Absolutely. Well, actually, there's been some research by public opinion scholars, particularly a scholar by the name of Wenfang Tang, who's working in Hong Kong now, used to be a professor in Iowa, who's done what's called list experiments, which are a way of testing for hidden biases in survey respondents. They've been particularly used actually to detect the latent racial anxiety of white voters about Barack Obama in the US. Mm. So he applied these experiments in China, and him and a couple of colleagues found that about 8 to 10% of people were disguising their unhappiness with Beijing.
Okay.
So if we take that finding and knock off 8 to 10% of the figures that I shared earlier, we still have very high levels of regime support, at least as expressed in these surveys. But, I mean, you're totally right that we need to, you know, be careful with interpreting this data.
Sure, sure.
And it's for certain that these are, you know, reflecting the opinions of, you know, probably the majority Han population within China, and almost certainly don't represent you know, the majority of people within minority communities like Uyghurs and Tibetans.
That's right. That's the other criticism you routinely hear is that they're not polling people who are on the margins of Chinese society.
But when you do test some of the previous results, say the World Values Survey, you can quite easily triangulate that with data on gender, data on earnings, data on education level, and the responses to that question of how much confidence you have in your government is pretty consistent across those groups.
Interesting.
But we do have to remember that there are a lot of groups that do not experience the Chinese government the same way as those who are perhaps benefiting from its economic growth without having to suffer any of the consequences.
As I suggested, this all touches on the issue of legitimacy. And there are a lot of people who, I think, especially here in the United States, who believe that elections are really the sine qua non of political legitimacy. And there's something about this idea of performance legitimacy that really sticks in the craw of many Americans. So leaving aside the question of whether by this measure, you know, of requiring political democracy to have anything like legitimacy, leaving aside the question of whether that would leave any legitimate states on the planet between, you know, the time of Pericles and the late 18th century, how do we assess for the authoritarian states? How do we measure, how do we establish that a state does possess what you've, and all, what I think everyone's taken to calling performance legitimacy? I mean, is it just the absence of large-scale, you know, rebellion or efforts to overthrow the state? And can we speak of performance legitimacy at sort of sub-national levels, like, you know, as we were saying, in Xinjiang, for example?
That's a very deep philosophical question, and many a treatise has been written about political legitimacy. But I think, barring the impossibility of one good answer to that question, I think it really just depends on, yes, on who you are, because different people are going to have different definitions of legitimacy. I mean, we in the West, you know, do see, you know, elections, do see rights, do see freedoms as a key marker of legitimacy. But I think the data that we've just been discussing on, you know, regime support in China do suggest that, you know, there are a lot of Chinese, and this would probably be true in other countries too, who see, you know, that performance legitimacy of economic growth as being at least sufficient to be satisfied with the performance of their government.
Right.
And one of the ways I looked at this in the Market Watch piece that you raised earlier was kind of drilling down on some of those subsets of the headline figures, because we all know that China's economy has grown at, you know, almost 10% annually over the last four decades. Real GDP per capita has increased many, many fold. You know, life expectancy, public health, education have all improved a lot. But there's some data on just the amount of consumer durables in Chinese households that the National Bureau of Statistics published for a few decades. And I think these data really help us understand the kind of tangible improvements in living standards that many people in China have seen over the last few decades, and which I would infer are, you know, good reasons for people to be generally satisfied with what's going on. Because, I mean, you look at, say, just air conditioners, for instance, in 1990, which was, you know, just within my lifetime, out of every 100 urban households in China, 0.3 had an air conditioner.
Wow.
That's a pretty uncomfortable place to be in.
Oh, yeah.
Having lived through a few Chinese summers.
Oh, boy.
But in 2012, the last year that they published this data, it was 126.8 air conditioners per 100 households.
Wow.
And that's, yeah, it's an enormous improvement in 22 years. And it's a similar kind of pattern for like heated showers, color TVs, refrigerators, washing machines. And whilst these might not be sufficient for us in terms of generating legitimacy, these are at least go some way to explaining why a lot of Chinese who have benefited from China's economic rise and quite phenomenal economic achievements would be quite satisfied with the regime and would generally be approving of its performance, at least as it relates to their daily lives.
Well, I know on a hot summer day in China, air conditioning alone would take me a lot of the distance toward regime support. I know it would take my children all the way there and beyond. I think they'd be willing to lay down lives for it. Anyway, you flicked just now at this sort of chasm that separates American political culture from Chinese. China Twitter might know the name Matthew Stinson. He's an English teacher in Tianjin. We were chatting one night, and he summed up things really nicely. He characterized the American perspective as, "Why don't you Chinese hate your government as much as I think you should?" Which I thought was a pretty clever way of putting it. And a big part of it, I think, is this American belief that, I mean, Benjamin Franklin once said something like, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety, which is, you know, a clever turn of phrase. But I don't know whether any Chinese person in their right mind wouldn't make such a trade just based on the historical experience, I mean, that's still in the living memory of so many of them. Now, I ended up writing this 8,000-word Quora answer, basically trying to answer this question, but I'm sure you have maybe an easier answer as to why it is that Chinese do not hate their government as much as Americans might think they should, based on things that we were talking about, on rampant human rights violations, on the lack of political freedoms, on the lack of democracy, on lack of a free press.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the raw data we've been discussing on Chinese regime support and increases in standards of living are pretty widely accepted within the scholarly community.
Yeah.
But you're right that the big question is, I mean, why is this recorded support so high? And on this point, there's a lot of different explanations that have found some support within the academic and the journalistic literature. And probably the main ones are, you know, economic growth, which we've been talking about, in the performance legitimacy of improving people's lives. I'd also add that the questions that get asked of Chinese about whether their children today will be better off financially than their parents consistently record extremely high answers, even up to about 2016. So fairly recently, you have anywhere from 82% to 88% of Chinese thinking that will be the case between 2013 and 2016.
And until recently, they were very empirically grounded. I mean, there was no reason not to believe that, right? You saw the trend lines pretty obviously.
Yeah, and compare that to the US. And these are much more comparable questions, I'd say, than the regime support ones.
Sure.
About 33 to 37% over the last 5 years in the US have agreed with that statement that children today were better off financially than their parents. So we see a lot more optimism based on the track record of the Chinese government's performance. And I'd say it would take quite a lot to budge that into, negative territory or under 50% compared to the U.S.
That optimism isn't just economically founded, right? I mean, we must believe that information controls, that propaganda, the indoctrination that students get about the century of humiliation and, the CCP's historic role in fighting Japan, which is, routinely exaggerated. But in other words, patriotic education, it must play no small part in these levels, in these numbers.
Absolutely. And I was very careful to make a strong point of that in that Market Watch piece that we've been discussing. And there's absolutely no doubt that China's, very expansive system of propaganda, patriotic education, censorship, control, play a big part in shaping these views, because that's the environment that people grow up in. It's not determinative by any means. There's a wide diversity of opinion within the Chinese population, whether they're in China, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in Macau, in the US, anywhere else overseas. But the general kind of default setting that kind of people learn about the world in school and through reading the news, it's a closed information ecosystem, unless right. you have a VPN to jump the firewall. But actually not that great a proportion of Chinese do.
It's a tiny proportion. It's kind of shockingly small.
So yeah, we would be very remiss to ignore these, if you like, negative reasons why Chinese support the government. But I guess the point of the piece was that there are also positive reasons.
So yeah, exactly. On the 70th anniversary of the founding of the PRC, which was just a little over a week ago as we record, there was this whole flurry of discussion again about what the real attitudes of the Chinese people are. I mean, if you were to strip this away, all of this other stuff, propaganda and media controls, if you were to strip away censorship. And this was, of course, especially resonant because of what's happening in Hong Kong. It struck me as evidence for the state of discourse outside of China about this subject of the CCP's legitimacy that Ian Johnson of the New York Times published an op-ed to make the point that had this been almost any other country's national celebration, it would have been so banal a point that it wouldn't have merited attention, let alone like an op-ed in the New York Times. I mean, the claim that some of the support from people around him in Tiananmen Square watching the parade, watching the fireworks, was honest, heartfelt, patriotic emotion. It really says something interesting about the state of discourse about China that we have trouble believing that.
And I think a lot of the difficulty with bringing in the propaganda and nationalism factors into regime support, and they're obviously very important, I don't mean to deny that. It's quite hard to measure, and it's also quite hard to separate what is government-produced nationalism from what is just natural patriotism. Because there's that old George Bernard Shaw quote that this discussion reminded me of, so I pulled it up. It's the, patriotism is the belief your country is superior to all other countries because you were born in it. And I think that's something that's universal. People love their country because that's where they're from. That's where their family are. That's where they grew up. That's where home is. So it's very hard to separate that, which I think you'd find in any country, from that effect created by the government. There's definitely a real part of it, but splicing those two is very difficult. But I would note that, propaganda has been an increasing focus in the last few years under Xi Jinping. So there is perhaps more of that coming to the fore in these incredibly enormous parades, and in terms of more focused propaganda, better propaganda, more resources being put into propaganda, and tighter control in the ideological sphere.
Right. Another thing that you flicked at in the Market Watch piece was this essay that was written, I think, like 20 years ago now, by Jeff Wasserstrom of UC Irvine. The title of that essay was "Big Bad China and the Good Chinese People." What is problematic to you about this distinction that we so often see people making now between the Chinese Communist Party and the people of China? I mean, I get the impulse to do this. I mean, to say I'm not against China, just against its ruling party, and to push back against the CCP's efforts to conflate these two things, which they do. They try to conflate these things, not just in Chinese people's minds, but in everyone's minds. But what's the problem in your mind with that bifurcation?
So I think the problem with that bifurcation in my mind is that it's just not completely true. I do fully subscribe to the notion that, American foreign policy should be targeting Beijing rather than Chinese people. I think that's a totally sensible thing to be pursuing in Washington. But I think if you allow that distinction to inform all of your thinking about Beijing and about the resilience of the Chinese government, then you're making a mistake, because not every Chinese person dreams of freedom the same way that Americans do. And it's a mistake to kind of impute all of our preferences and our desires onto the Chinese people. There are certainly a large number of Chinese people who do feel those things, and they should be supported. We should support them. But there is a diversity of opinion, and a lot of Chinese are patriotic, and their patriotism is one that is aligned with the CCP and the PRC, and they aren't particularly interested in becoming just like us.
You said that a lot better than I could have been, I would have been able to, but yeah, I mean, I feel exactly the same way. It also just sometimes just strikes me as positively insincere when it comes from certain people. They make this distinction, but then in practice, I see them slip all the time, and they do it themselves. They end up attacking this notional China instead of singling out this odious political party that they profess to hate. Anyway, that's.
I think that does reflect a broader point, though. It's like people really like to think in dualities. I think that's increasingly kind of defining well, the discourse in America and also in China, I'd add, you know, that America is good and China is evil, the reverse in Beijing, that the Chinese people want our way of life, the Chinese government is doing all it can to destroy our way of life, that, you know, if you write about China, you're either pro-China or you're anti-China. And, you know, it's quite, you know, comfortable and maybe emotionally invigorating to, you know, navigate the world through these dualistic perspectives, but they're only a kind of vague representation of what's always at least a slightly more complex reality. There are obviously some issues where it's far more clear-cut than others, but still, like, dualities are rarely helpful when it comes to actually making policy that gets results and improves the security of America for Washington or for China in Beijing.
That's right. There was another thing in the piece that Ian wrote that leapt out at me. And that was when he was describing the people around him who were experiencing that surprisingly authentic, you know, patriotic emotion. Many of them were, as you said, they were scientists, they were intellectuals, people who had made some contribution to the state in the last 70 years. But it was, I think we've gotten to the point in our discourse again where we've come to conflate the word intellectual with the word dissident when it comes to China. If you look at who among Chinese intellectuals gets translated into English, who gets covered, who gets to write op-eds in the New York Times, like Ian. It's not surprising that it skews very much in favor of critics and dissidents. If you just look at like the Chinese names who've written New York Times articles, it's, you know, Rong Xuezun and Liao Yiwu and Yu Hua and all these people who are quite, you know, strident critics. And then when you have somebody sort of on the other side, I almost suspect they're there to look deliberately ridiculous. You have, you know, Zhang Weiwei, who is just, I mean, for me, just embarrassing to read. You don't end up having people who I think are more sort of representative of the average kind of Chinese intellectual. But again, that hardly would merit an op-ed. I mean, you're not going to write a story with a headline that says Tsinghua professor thinks things are basically okay, just need some tweaking on the edges. That's not gonna do it. But I think intellectuals are so important to our understanding of the dynamic of Chinese politics. I mean, you know, between the pen and the sword, that's sort of the piston and the cam of Chinese, you know, of Chinese politics. And we don't understand one whole part of it. I mean, this is something I think it was Jude Blanchett who once asked me, who is a representative intellectual sort of from that milquetoast middle? Who is the David Brooks of China, as he put it? You know, that's a tough question. I don't think there's an easy answer to that, but I keep looking for him. Who's somebody who represents a kind of a bland establishment? And how do we go about trying to understand him better?
I guess it's a question of what the establishment exactly is. I think there's plenty of intellectuals and academics in China who mostly publish fairly supportive things of the Chinese government. Some who are very enthusiastic about the Chinese system, and increasingly so over recent years. So someone like Hu Angang, who has, you know, being someone who's really driven policy on a lot of issues.
Not in a good direction.
And not in a good direction, especially when it comes to, you know, ethnic policy, which we're seeing, you know, play out with the Uyghurs and the Hui and other groups right now.
Right.
But I'd say a lot of most intellectuals and academics are, you know, if not just, you know, neutral kind of supporters in the background, but also, you know, quite happy to champion many things that they find to be attractive or find to be useful for themselves within the Chinese system. And there's a whole like range, not just, you know, it's kind of like with the establishment ones, but there's also the liberal ones and also the far more conservative, far hardline ones. So I mean, there's really like quite a range within that, but obviously within the bounds of acceptable expression. But you do try and see some people trying to push that.
My point is that they're just not really highlighted ever, and we rarely know their names in the West. Even people who are fairly serious China watchers don't, you know, they don't have a ready answer to who is the David Brooks of China, some sort of pundit who is widely published.
I would encourage everyone who's interested there in that question to check out the website Reading the China Dream. I'm not personally involved in it, so I'm a neutral bystander, but it publishes some excellent translations of contemporary Chinese intellectuals and, you know, their kind of major works. It's one in particular that I was reading just recently that kind of relates to this podcast by Wang Xiaoguang, who's an emeritus professor from, I think, the Chinese University of Hong Kong. You know, had kind of been writing for many decades about this, and it's called Representative and Representational Democracy. And it kind of compares China's, you know, kind of mass line inspired interaction with the people versus the electoral interaction with the people that Western governments have. And he ends up concluding that the Chinese system is better and actually allows for more participation. And, you know, uses that as an argument to justify, you know, the Beijing government and its superiority over the West. So there's a lot of essays like that, and from people like him on the site, and it really is a fantastic resource.
Yeah.
If you want to read these in translation,
that leads really quite naturally into what I wanted to ask you about MBLL, the message board for local leaders, or the Divang Lingdao Liu Yanbai. You had written a piece on Marco Polo, I think earlier, probably in the spring of this year, about how the CCP is actually quite responsive to public opinion in China, and what the party does to gauge, to monitor, and to react to that public opinion. Can you talk about that? Because I think this whole puzzle of authoritarian resilience, which, you know, we've been wrestling with a lot recently, although I guess we've moved on now to trying to understand the whole democratic backslide. Part of that, I think, is because of this focus on public opinion that the party has really kind of taken quite seriously. Talk about that, about MBLL, the message board for local leaders.
Sure, and this is all part of this idea of what public opinion is and what it means, right? We associate public opinion with, you know, popular democratic participation in elections, the opinion polls are what we use to drive coverage in presidential elections and primary elections. But I think, yeah, the point of this kind of peace and these kind of systems is that public opinion is not necessarily a force for democratic transformation, but it can actually be used by authoritarian governments to solidify their rule and to improve the governance that they can deliver to their people. Because, I mean, turning back to this idea of the mass line, which is kind of that the Communist Party goes into the people, it asks them what they want, then it formulates policies, brings them back, tests them out, gets more opinions from the people, goes back and then perfects the policies and then rolls them out to the warm embrace of the masses. That's the ideal. Obviously, it's completely controlled within the bounds of the Communist Party, but it does want to get input and information from the people because that helps it rule better. And it's much easier to rule a country if you have a citizenry that is accepting or at least acquiescent to what's going on, rather than one that is, you know, in open revolt and rebellion. And so Xi Jinping has been very clear that one of the ways to, you know, follow this mass line approach to governance is through the internet and through monitoring what citizens say on the internet and soliciting opinions from, you know, ordinary citizens about how the government's doing. And it's usually the local governments.
Right.
So he's kind of issued this order to get online to local governments, because that's where public opinion is and that's where this really valuable information is. Because as we all know, the Communist Party doesn't have elections with which to collect, you know, opinion on performance that way. So yes, the MBLL is a online platform run by the People's Daily Online. Mm-hmm. It's also an app. There's also a WeChat program. And it basically just lets Chinese netizens leave public messages for either provincial, city, or county governments. And then these governments can either reply to that message, and that's also public, or they can just not respond. But the platform kind of tallies all of these messages and all of these responses. And at least when I was writing the piece, I collected data up to the end of April this year. And since it started in 2006, there'd been something like 1.7 million messages, and about 66% of those had received at least a reply. That doesn't necessarily mean something was done,
right?
But there was an acknowledgement, and there was potential for action from that local government. And because it's all public, there is theoretically more pressure on governments to act. And I mean, perhaps an indication of it becoming more effective is that the number of messages left has been increasing dramatically over the last couple of years, and the response rate is now something like 80%, which is much higher than the overall average of 65%.
Which is from 2006, right?
Takes in data going back to, 2006. And so obviously, there's only a certain type of messages you can leave. Like, if you leave a message on a sensitive political topic or calling for Xi Jinping to resign, that's definitely going to get deleted.
Right.
But in terms of issues like, wage arrears or outdated neighborhoods that need redoing, forced land seizures, these are all pretty common, some of the most common issues on the MBLL. Healthcare is another big issue.
Yeah, you actually did a word cloud about MBLL messages. What did that seem to tell you? I remember seeing things like healthcare and Chai Chen and stuff like that.
So the original Chinese one was actually a courtesy of the People's Daily Online itself. They very handily provided that to all their readers.
Oh.
And then we translated it into English, or most of it anyway. One of the things you see is that most of these complaints are from, they're rural issues, or they're issues that are faced by, lower income urbanites. So it's kind of a way for those that aren't necessarily very enfranchised by other parts of the political system to, voice their grievances and to, connect directly to local governments who, many of which have, formal regulations about how to deal with these complaints. And, as we've seen from the statistics, many of them do at least respond. And, this has to be taken with a grain of salt, obviously, but the People's Daily claims that over 50% of the users of the MBLL were, quote, satisfied with the reply they received.
Hmm.
So it does seem that something is happening. And there was actually scholarly research that shows that the higher number of messages left for particular localities' leaders did tend to correlate with more attention paid to welfare in government work reports, and also increased coverage of the DBAO, like the kind of universal basic income for poor Chinese. So the research that's just coming out, because it's still quite a new initiative, does seem to indicate that while it may not be revolutionary, and it's certainly not leading to any kind of democratic transformation, this platform, the MBLL, is effective for the central government in at least having some kind of effect on improving the public service delivery of local governments, which is great for Beijing because that increases the legitimacy, increases the satisfaction of citizens everywhere with their government. And there's different response rates in different places, but you do kind of tend to find that there's a virtuous cycle between the quantity of responses and the quantity of messages. So when it does get started, it does seem to start working.
Interesting. It isn't anonymous, right? I'm presumably you have some identification that you have to post in your real name.
Yes, you can't see all of the data if you're just a casual user, but if you want to actually log a message or a complaint or a request for information, there's always different types of things you can do on the platform. You do have to provide your full name and identification number,
right?
And things like that.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Neil, you've also written about the importance of anniversaries to the Chinese Communist Party, and maybe paraphrasing you here, how lacking the popular mandate that elections would confer, the party plays up its historical role as one of the big cornerstones of its political legitimacy. Can you expand on this a little bit and talk about 2019, which is just a year that was packed with a lot of these nice round anniversaries?
Yeah, so 2019 really has been a big year. Obviously, the major one was the 70th anniversary of the PRC, which was got the big October the 1st military parade.
Sure.
But yeah, there's a whole lot more. The anniversary of Macau coming back to Chinese sovereignty is on December 20th. There's the Tiananmen anniversary, obviously.
Of course.
The Urumqi riots, the Falun Gong crackdown.
The Belgrade bombing.
Yep, the Belgrade bombing. There's a lot going on. Perhaps a little...
Of course, May 4th.
Yep, May 4th, obviously, a huge one. And yeah, I mean, anniversaries are important, at least in my reading, precisely because the government, the Chinese Communist Party, makes them important. And it goes to this question of legitimacy and the role of propaganda as well that we were talking about before. And if you read, you know, the Chinese Constitution... the party constitution, history is a big part of the official legitimation of the regime. You know, that's a century of humiliation narrative whereby China was, you know, under the yoke of foreign powers since the first Opium War in the 1840s and suffered from, you know, wave after wave of invasions and exploitation. And the Chinese Communist Party in this narrative played the starring role as the liberators of China, and finally, you know, bringing China back under Chinese control and removing, you know, foreign influence and removing, you know, foreign control over Chinese destiny.
Right.
So that's certainly, you know, there's also an organic part of that as well, I'd say. And this is what's been picked up as well by a lot of, you know, writers like Ian Johnson too, and Li Yuan, right, both writing in The Times, that, you know, this achievement that Mao did is something that people, you know, still can appreciate.
Yeah, it resonates particularly with them still.
If, you know, particularly if you perceive that China isn't getting the kind of respect or the opportunities it deserves on the international scene today. So yeah, without this kind of popular mandates from elections, these kind of anniversary celebrations are a reminder to people, a kind of very emotional reminder to people that the Communist Party has played in some ways a positive role in China's history in terms of, you know, achieving this independence from foreign powers, even if that they weren't the only people responsible for it.
Right. This anniversary consciousness strikes me as very much a double-edged sword. I mean, for every one of these great events deserving of commemoration in the party historiography, there's a dark anniversary too, right? I mean, we just rattled off a list of some, and some of them were, you know, the Urumqi riots, the Falun Gong crackdown in 1999. There were a number in that list that you have at the bottom there of the lists of the nines that were dark anniversaries, as you describe them. Talk a little bit about dark anniversaries, you know, the contested anniversary dates.
Yep. So dark anniversaries is a term that I borrow from Jeremy Barme at China Heritage, and it refers to significant dates in the history of China. June 4th, 1989 is the big one.
Mm-hmm.
That are not at all marked in the calendar of official celebrations and are in fact actively suppressed.
Right.
And people are prevented from celebrating them. So these are kind of focal points for dissent. There's some great work being done on this by Rory Truex actually at Princeton, who kind of theorizes that these dates serve as what he calls focal points that help protesters and dissidents in authoritarian countries to overcome the information barriers to collective action, because you know it's significant and you know there's going to be other people who think it's significant. So it helps you to act.
Right. They have tremendous symbolic valence. I think even if you just go to 1989, the students had in their hands a lot of these very valent nice round anniversary dates. They had the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution. They had the 40th anniversary of the founding of the PRC. And of course, they had the 70th anniversary of the May 4th movement, all of which, you know, sort of gave them this revolutionary cred that they were able to deploy pretty effectively. So yeah, I think I'd be really interested in reading Rory's work on
that. Yeah, and you saw that with a lot of things in 89. There's obviously a huge march on Tiananmen on the anniversary on May 4th. There were also things like a May 4th journal that was published, a May 4th signs.
That's right.
In the square, a manifesto. So a very conscious deployment of this historical anniversary for purposes that did not advance the agenda of the Communist Party. And so hence, there's just been increasing and increasing repression of those kind of behaviors in China since then. And I think you really are seeing that the potential, at least in my view, of these dark anniversaries to serve subversive ends is really diminishing, particularly over the last few years.
Fascinating. So let's end this chat by turning to what's happened just in the last few days. Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted and then soon afterward deleted a message calling for supporting freedom for Hong Kong. Everyone knows that now. That set off fury in China among ordinary people. It was obviously augmented by bots and perhaps by paid commenters. And it triggered responses that have so far included a rather abject apology, at least in the Chinese version of it, from the NBA, CCTV decision not to air any more NBA shows this season. And then there were other things that happened too. I mean, you had that animated, pretty reliably irreverent show South Park, which ran an episode called Banned in China, B-A-N-D, a little double entendre because part of it involves a rock band that they form, which is, again, runs into trouble. It got the show pulled off the air, off the major online video sites like Youku. And then Blizzard, which is a major game publisher, banned an e-games athlete for his supposed anti-China statements. So how does the Chinese response in these cases fit into your understanding of public opinion and regime legitimacy in China?
I think it really shows the kind of complex interaction between people and the state, in the sense that a lot of the reaction is bottom-up reaction from netizens, but that's also supported by pretty explicit signals from the state that this is supported. So comments being made by state media on their social media channels and in articles that clearly signal that this is a line of attack that is approved and something that's not going to get you in trouble. So that feeds back into the Chinese web. And so more and more people kind of pile on to this nationalism.
Right.
And if nationalism is high, which it is in China, some researchers think it's the highest in the world, although there's some issues with cross-national comparisons, then it's a real tinderbox. But we do have to bear in mind that the Chinese government could stop this if they wanted to, and they're choosing not to. So it's a pretty strong signal that there is support for this line of attack from the authorities.
We're just in one of those moments of extreme prickliness where there's a high degree of ambient irritability where the littlest thing, the littlest slight or perceived insult will set off one side or the other. It's very unfortunate. Anyway, Neil Thomas, man, it was great to finally have you on the show. I look forward to having you back. Meanwhile, let us move on to recommendations. But first, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca or the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best thing that you can do to show that support is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter. The thing is just chock full of great reads on China, all delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy, Lucas, Xiaoyun, the whole team, they work their butts off to bring you this amazing product, and it is just terrific value for money. So sign up, spread the word, and I also want to make sure you are all subscribed to our latest show, Strangers in China. If you haven't heard episode 2, that's been my favorite. It's just terrific. You're going to really dig it. Anyway, on to recommendations. Neil, what do you have for us?
Well, I'd like to first do a little bit of log rolling and say that Macro Polo is currently hiring. We're looking for a research fellow focused on tech and economics in China.
Oh, great.
So if you're interested in working for us, check out the website, macropolo.org, and you'll be able to find the details. But my recommendation is an article in the latest China Leadership Monitor by a scholar called Ryan Manuel called Twists in the Belt and Road. Full disclosure, he's a former boss of mine, but he plows through immense volumes of Chinese policy documents to piece together how the institutions of Chinese governance work. And he has some amazing kind of graphical breakdowns of the authority relationships between different parts of the Chinese bureaucracy that are responsible for the Belt and Road. And he uses this to advance a very interesting take that the BRI is not a a massive geopolitical master plan for world domination, but is rather an enormous economic policy that is kind of rife with internal resistance and bureaucratic conflicts. And basically, there's a lot more than meets the eye in many of our current discussions on the BRI.
Oh, great.
It's a fantastic read and really kind of delves deeper than most of the other coverage I've seen.
Maybe I'll read that paper and see if I can get him on the show. That sounds like a really interesting topic. I trust you will help me make that introduction.
Absolutely.
All right. My recommendation is, the China History podcast, one of the best, the longest running English language podcasts on China. They're 10 years old, just about. They have new episodes out now on the warlord period. It's really he. It's Laszlo Montgomery. It's a one-man show. He's just in fine, fine form on the two that have dropped so far. He thinks this is going to be the longest series ever, longer than I think it was like the 8 episodes that he did on Tang poetry or on Zhou Enlai. And I think he did 10 on the history of tea. So this is even going to be longer than that. I am really interested in the warlord period, having pretty close familial ties with two of the more prominent warlords. I am pretty completely absorbed in this and cannot wait for the next ones to drop. So, Laszlo, man, if you're listening, get to it. Anyway, thanks, Neil. That was great, man. I really appreciated that.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldhorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the other podcasts in our network. The Taishin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, New Voices, and Ta for Ta, the Middle Earth podcast on the cultural industry in China, and of course, our brand new family member, Strangers in China. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care. Hey again. So a couple of weeks ago on the show, I was talking with Jude Blanchette about Hong Kong and about the impact of propaganda on mainland Chinese attitudes toward the protests. I said something like, this nonsense about the National Endowment for Democracy and foreign black hands, sure, that clearly comes from propaganda. You know, it's honest to God fake news. So I got a note from a listener who pushed back on that, and I did a little homework, and I just wanted to clarify that I think I was a bit too blithely dismissive. This is not to say that I believe that the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, has directly funded protesters or that they instigated the protests themselves. I still think that the NED is a boogeyman whose role is just routinely inflated and gets blamed for way too many things that it had no hand in at all. I am also quite certain that the protests would have happened with or without the involvement of the NED. But maybe I should have acknowledged that the NED does fund pro-democracy organizations in Hong Kong. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Funding social goods or institutions, as one friend of mine, Taisu Zhang, commented, is not the same as funding the protests themselves. And he went on to say, so did the NED funding contribute, however insignificantly, to the overall social infrastructure and discourse that fed into the protests? Undoubtedly. But so did 100 other NGOs and even academic organizations that condemned, correctly or not, rights deprivation and advocated for socio-political activism. Anyway, NED discloses who they fund, for how much, and for what purposes all on their website, which is ned.org, and you can go there and judge for yourself. They have funded a number of Hong Kong-related initiatives, but only to the tune of about $1.76 million over the last 5 years, so that's not a whole lot of money. Anyway, thanks a lot.